Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies. I'm Neil Rosen. If I sound a little low energy, I have a cold. So my wonderful
Thank God you're here. You're plodding through.
Might do more of the majority of the talking today than me, but knowing me, that maybe that just won't happen at all. I'm joined, as always, by Bill Brigoli.
Hi there.
And Bill McCuddy.
I'm here.
And who is on our television show today, joining us on the podcast, is Justine Browning. Hi, Justine.
Neil Rosen has a code, like has a cold.
Like Frank Sinatra has a cold in the Esquire.
Article, the gold standard of the profile feature.
This woman, by the way, is the youngest woman I've ever met that has all these like 70s and 60s and 80s
I thought you were going to say the youngest woman I've ever met.
She made a reference to Psycho earlier in the green room.
Janet Leigh's death and Psycho.
The shortest the scene since Janet Leigh's death in Psycho. I'm like, did you even see that? So anyway, she's very hip.
That's the mark
she's
of a
very
great
hip.
Movie critic. I mean,
thank you.
Listen, when you let's
or Justine,
when you were let's say 25 years old,
right.
Okay, weren't you able to reference point movies from the 40s and the 30s before your
yes?
Time?
But I will say most
yeah,
of the
I could. I was actually married to someone who.
Got killed early after the opening credits?
No. She was a big fan of 40s and 50s movies and had all these books that listed all the background players. She had these cool – she could tell you. She could see some guy
wow.
in the background. She said, oh, he always plays a farmer. Oh, yeah,
wow.
And she knew their names.
It's William Demarest.
Yeah. She knew all those. She knew all the bits.
This is way off topic, but did everybody except Justine in this room have Leonard Maltin's movie books when you were growing up?
Are you kidding me?
Of course.
I
oh, you
had
did too?
Leonard Maltin. I
like, still those came out every couple of years and he updated. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, Leonard Maltin.
Did that internet
totally
invalidate that particular
yes,
yeah,
stopped,
I would say.
He
no,
stopped
absolutely.
Releasing those books.
No, you're
but
kidding, but you're not wrong.
It was
that's
called
the
TV
because
movies,
before,
and it was every movie that was
every,
on.
Before
right.
you could just go on IMDb and look a person up and find all their credits,
right.
you would grab the Leonard Maltin book off the shelf,
right.
the shelf and you're, when you were on your cordless phone, and you would look in the back and see, look up an actor, and it would tell you in the index all their movies. You
right.
would write that person. It would take much longer.
And it would rate them, and it would be how many stars. And everybody said,
stars,
how did Leonard Maltin see all those movies? And the truth is he had some helpers,
many.
And he culled from reviews around the country. But the point is, he made a book every couple of years. I won't say every year, but for a couple of years it was every year, but then it was every like 2 or 3 years, that took into account every movie that was on cable or had been
and that
released.
And it kept getting bigger.
And it
bigger.
Was like, it was
like
a paperback.
Size of like five
but it was
like, yeah, phone
right,
books.
Right,
and it was
right,
exciting
right,
when
right.
it would come
except
out.
Tiny phone book, like big, like thick, but small.
I'll tell you a story. Before, by the way, we're going to talk about The Jungle Book today. We're going to talk about Demolition. We're going to talk about The Adderall Diaries. We're going to talk about a movie called Mr. Right.
That's a good host. He gets us back on the track.
No, but
I'm sorry
just,
to have derailed
But
the
I will tell you a story that a friend of mine who
Gather
has,
around the louds-
passed,
loudspeaker
has passed away,
kids.
A great guy by the name of Glenn Steinfast, who was Joel Siegel's producer. Do you remember Glenn?
Oh, that was Glenn's last name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Glenn was a great guy.
Yeah.
So it's about 20 years ago, and I'm having coffee somewhere with Glenn. And he goes, I got this great, and the internet was relatively new.
Mm.
It was actually not even, it was like. Nobody.
Oh, I love this story. I forgot this story.
So Glenn goes to me, I got an idea. He goes, I want it, and it was kind of like the Leonard Maltin TV movies book, but he didn't reference point that book. But he goes, let's do a website with every single movie like ever made and every information, all the information you could possibly gather about that movie. And we'll do a website, and that'll be the go-to website. And I'm going, like an idiot, I go, That's impossible. How could you possibly ever like do something like that? I'm not doing that. And of course, IMDb right. gets bought by who owns them? Like Google or somebody?
Yeah, Yahoo or somebody. Yeah,
millions of dollars. So Glenn,
yeah.
Do you remember what I said when you told me that story? Sometimes it's not the idea; it's the execution. Meaning, yes, a lot of people have great ideas. And to take nothing away from Glenn, he was a lovely guy. I saw him on the Oscars every year
yeah,
on the red carpet.
Guy.
He produced.
Passed away so young.
But it's
too.
About, yeah, life I have is. This great idea, or yeah, I have this great idea, and here's how we're going to get it done. And IMDb really got it done. They went out and they somehow got. Think about the beginning of that.
But
think
IMDb,
about,
is,
think about when it
IMDb
started.
Is that TV movies book?
No, of course,
on
of course,
computerish.
Yep.
But the
online
day before
form.
They went online, where were they getting all their stuff? Like they had to go. They had to be
maybe
like little pack rights going around everywhere
maybe they
and
just
getting
took,
all that
maybe
information.
They just took the Leonard Maltin book and just.
Well, that could
yeah,
have been a starting
that's true.
Point.
Maybe
that could
if you check the synopsises in the Leonard Maltin book and you read the IMDb
Leonard
thing,
Maltin,
who knows?
Parentheses IMDb.
Leonard Maltin had a great
anyway.
Show on the Reels channel called Secrets Out, where he would rank movies that no one's heard about or seen. It was incredible. I was canceled because the Reels channel kind of
This is wildly inappropriate, but is Leonard Maltin still with us?
Yes.
Leonard Maltin's around.
Okay.
It was a great...
He was on E.T. for a while as the...
Yes.
At CBS Radio News, he's the guy they call whenever somebody dies.
Yeah.
He also taught a class that I took that was great, an adult education class at the New School that was lined to get into it on animation, where you would show old Warner Brothers, like Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig cartoons, and tell you the stories about, it was fascinating, about like, you know, Chuck Jones and Friz Freleng and Robert McKimson and all these people that made these cartoons. It was fascinating. Now I'm going back like 30 years. But anyway, enough about
But apropos of a cartoon, we are talking about a movie that was a famous cartoon for a long time in Jungle Book and now is a quasi-live action.
In 1967, Disney released the Jungle Book.
Did you like that transition, by the way?
It was great.
Okay, thank you.
And it was a great, it was a really good cartoon. I mean, Louis Prima... doing I Want to Be Like You. That was great. So now Jon Favreau has reimagined, not that anybody was dying for...
How did he get this job, by the way? Off of Iron Man?
Well, first of all, the guy, Jon Favreau, is a really diverse director. I mean, Elf is one of the greatest funny family comedies of all time, and he directed that. Then he did Iron Man, which is...
Did Swingers before. I mean, he wrote Swingers.
A tremendous comic book movie. So now he takes on Disney, and I think he did a tremendous job.
I just don't know how you get that step up.
He did Elf.
No, he said Elf. But I don't know how you get that step up. I don't know how you get a Disney to come to somebody like that. What have you... Have you talked to Spielberg? Have you talked to... Who have you gone through to take nothing away from Jon Favreau? But, like, that's a huge...
First of all, I don't know. I think he directed the second Iron Man also, which was not that good of a film, but I can check that. But the point is, the first Iron Man was a several hundred million dollar blockbuster movie,
right?
Which used special effect. I mean, it's not that much of a leap. You know, it's not like he went from Swingers to doing this.
But Tony Stark is this snarky. And that franchise is
but look at all the
much
effect,
more PG look to R rated than anything Jungle Book.
Look
would
at
be.
All the effects in Iron Man, and look at all the.
That's true.
You know, I mean, it's not a put a camera in a room, and it's not like watching a Arthur Miller play. I mean, this is a really technically proficient
crucible with CGI. Yeah,
movie.
No,
it took a risk to a degree letting him work on this film, just in terms of filming it in the way that he did and using this new kind of technology that he did, and it actually, for a lot of people think, it really worked in their favor.
Well, we'll get
to
your opinion, and I'm going to tee that up for you in a second.
It's rare that studios give that trust, and I think sometimes it pans out. It's lightning in a bottle. It works because it's going to be a success.
I don't know where they got that.
Well, first of all, let's just say, if you haven't seen the movie or the original, it is based on Rudyard Kipling books by Rudyard Kipling. And Mowgli is a young boy who is raised in the jungle without any human contact.
Okay, so for the four people listening didn't know that.
He's raised by wolves, and he's chased away from his family of wolves.
By the way, in the original, I'm jumping ahead and then we'll jump back. In the original, was fire called the Red Rose or whatever the... I don't remember that fire
red
was
flower
the
was
red
the,
flower. Was yeah. that?
I don't remember that in the original.
I think that's a affectation of this version.
No, you know what? I actually remember Louis Prima singing about the red flower.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
so the cartoon dealt with the fact that fire was this thing.
Man's
that,
red fire. I remember those the lyrics.
Which I think is very, very well handled in this film.
I mean, a lot more serious in tone than the 1967 animated version, which had more of a... jokey kind of style to it, I thought.
Right.
You know,
this gets jokey when Bill Murray shows up as the bear.
There is a not so subtle message that mankind ruins everything with fire, and that's why the tiger wants him dead, because the boy is going to grow up into a man.
But then, not to give too much away, he then goes and gets fire to help get rid of the. I mean, that was a misstep, I thought. But then the animals let water wash it all away, so it's okay. I'm gonna say right up front that I love this movie. Did not think I was going to. Had no. I'm not a huge fan of the cartoon. Remember that as a kid, but as being kind of dorky. This is like an amazing, amazing movie.
Okay, I'm gonna say my piece, and then I'm gonna have Bill Brigoli and Justine chime in. First of all, from a visual standpoint, I think the thing is dazzling. I mean, everything except for this kid, who's very good, played by Neil Sethi.
Sethi, yeah.
Sethi. is computer generated. It's all CGI technology.
But it doesn't look like a cartoon, we should say.
Now, all the animals, all of them, I mean, from the elephants to the snake that's voiced by Scarlett Johansson to even the very little forest creatures, everything.
Did you hear Gary Shanley?
I did. Yeah. His last screen.
I thought they should have done something bigger for him at the end of the movie, but I bet it was locked and they didn't have time. I know we're jumping around. I'm sorry, but at the end they give everybody in the credits a nice like picture in the book and their face and like who played them, and they didn't do it for Shandling, and I felt bad about that.
Well, I thought the 3D was amazing, and there's usually 3D.
You and I hate 3D. The glasses, the whole thing.
The 3D movies are usually just bad transfer jobs where they take a 2D movie.
And they're dark, and this movie is bright and light.
And only Avatar got it right, and this movie gets it right from 3D. But the whole thing is just, from a visual standpoint, it's amazing. I mean, the waterfalls, the rivers, the vines, everything is so realistic in the background. Was it photorealism? Was it all just completely Bregoli just generated in a computer, or did they take photographs?
Justine knows more about that stuff than I do.
Do you?
Was it CGI? It was all or motion capture?
No, it wasn't motion capture. Oh. The Jungle Book that's coming out, but for Disney soon. I'm just saying, is the one that's coming out is going to be motion capture. This was not.
Right, there's another Jungle Book in the works.
How effed up is that? How screwed up is Hollywood? I used to say Hollywood is like Noah's Ark. Every concept comes out in twos.
Yeah.
They're going to do another Jungle Book. Poor Andy Serkis, who's going to direct it.
Jungle Book Origins.
It got bumped two years now because of this movie, because this movie is so great.
In over 50 years, nobody's touched this movie. And now you've got
two. Right. Yeah, it's crazy.
It is ridiculous. But
Billy, do you like this movie?
I liked it. It took a little while for me to get used to the animals because, I don't know, something like animated animals talking is fine with me. But these animals were so realistic, it was a little odd to see human voices come out.
That's a compliment. I think you're paying it a compliment. I think this movie is amazing.
I was in awe of the way this thing looked visually. I could not believe what I was looking at. I was like,
but I'm thrilled to have another point of view here today.
I am. We've already said this. I'm Elaine from Seinfeld right now, just throwing the English patient. I'm like, I hate it. It's like, you don't like the Jungle Book? And I was like, I hate it.
One of the things you said on the show today was it was really obvious to you that it was somebody.
You're fired, Elaine.
It was
you
somebody,
are fired, Peter.
Or as Trump would say, you're fired. One of the things that you said on the show today that I couldn't believe was that you really felt like it was a kid in a green room acting with sock puppets or whatever they do. And, man, I was completely drawn into that jungle.
It felt to me, I could tell from watching it, I thought, okay, this was all created later. This doesn't feel realistic.
In fact, you could have told me that they went to Africa and filmed the kid running through the jungle and stuff and then added animated animals, and I would have believed that.
I mean, I wonder if it's because I knew going in that they didn't do that, but I could tell.
How can you say that this reminded you of like a studio in L.A. I mean, I just thought I was immersed in that jungle environment. Didn't you feel that way, Bill?
I did.
I think so. First of all, we've talked a little bit about this on the show, but I do feel that it was trying so hard to be funny and clever in terms of the script. I mean, maybe I'm focusing not on the visuals and just in terms of the overall content, and I don't think it transferred well to live action in that way. I didn't enjoy the performance by Neil Sethi. I didn't enjoy his interview.
I never quote Rotten Tomatoes. This is a Bill McCuddy
thing. I know, it has like 100%. I know.
It has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
It did as of a few days ago.
Not even like 90, it's 100%. I mean, 100.
No dissenters so far. So apparently you haven't posted your review on it.
Well, no, I know, I'll be the one to take it down. No, I'm sure there's going to be a bit more variety as more reviews come out, but everyone does keep talking about what a marvel it is. The sequel has already been greenlit. I don't know what this means for the Andy Serkis version.
They're going to do a sequel to this?
Yesterday they announced it.
Jungle Book 2. Electric Boogaloo.
Which I think is going to help it, you know, even more so
with
at the box office.
Favreau's
going to
direct it?
He is. Yeah. I think it's going to help it more, but yeah, I felt a lot
I think it'll do what Godfather 2 did, which is it'll go back before and jump back in time a little.
When so Mowgli was in the womb.
We'll get a sense of the bees actually making the honey, and then before that. You know what
well,
I wish
well,
we had? I wish
find
we had
his
some
brother, and he's gonna and he's gonna, like Godfather 2, and he's gonna kill his brother, and he's gonna go like Fredo go fishing. It's gonna be.
I'm a huge fan of Jon Favreau, and I would have loved to have known, for example, what did he think of the original Jungle Book?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've got audio because I am the vice president of audio, and I've got a lovely clip of Jon Favreau. Well, actually, let's start with the cute one first is him talking about, as a young boy, he actually dreamt of Mowgli when the original movie came out.
The first dream I ever remember having was of Mowgli riding in the backseat of my parents' Toyota through Manhattan as I stood on the street corner and watched him going by through the window. And I don't know what that means, and I'm not sure what it represents, but I do remember vividly that Mowgli was a character that I must have related very much to.
And then I've got John talking about how the 1967 animated movie influenced this one.
Even though that was a G-rated musical for children, and this was more of a PG adventure film that was more in the spirit of maybe the older animated Disney films or Lion King, I still wanted to include images from that. And some of those images were Mowgli singing with Baloo as they floated in the river. One of it was Ka with his eyes, with his scintillating eyes, hypnotizing Mowgli, who's trapped in his coils. I remember the marching elephants. I remember the tiger stalking through the grass, and I remember him being scared of the fire. I remember the temple collapsing, the monkeys snatching up Mowgli. So I wanted to grab things that I knew that other people my age would remember and make sure that I infuse it into the story so that if you're looking for that, if you're looking for that emotional connection to the music, to the moments, they'd be there. But then we could build upon that and create something that's a little bit more ambitious when it comes to the action aspect of the movie.
I mean, I think that Toyota thing is amazing, but I'm not sure that that's true. I'm going to call bullshit on that because, like, you hire a guy and you go, here, you're going to be in charge of this movie, and suddenly he goes, you know, it's funny you hired me for this because when I was a kid, I dreamt my parents were driving through Manhattan in a Toyota and I saw Mowgli. But anyway, he did an amazing job. I'm glad he's back for two.
I liked Christopher Walken as King Louis,
awesome.
Although I do prefer his Louis Prima's version of the song, I Want to Be Like You. But I still think he did a good job. You didn't find Bill Murray funny as Baloo the Bear?
Bill Murray was the best part to me. Yes, yes.
You keep talking about comedy, and the movie doesn't get funny to me until Bill Murray shows up, right?
That part was clever, but again, I felt, and this is obviously kind of a drastic comparison, but I felt it suffered from a lot of the same issues that Pan did.
Really?
Where it just wasn't, to me, as an adult, there wasn't anything about it that I could say, that's intriguing, or aside from the visuals.
You know what's funny about you saying that is that I walked out of that movie going, I'm going to tell adults to go see this movie without their kids. If they can go with their kids, fine. But if the kids go, we're doing something else, we're at Dave and Buster's.
I took my wife without our daughter.
Right.
My daughter's up in college, and she walked out of the thing going, like, that was incredible.
Yeah.
Beyond the age of six, I cannot see.
So here's the thing.
Don't agree at all.
So now there's a Beauty and the Beast live-action movie in the works from Disney.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to... Are they going to start remaking... we recently had Cinderella.
Cinderella did so well.
We had a remake.
Maleficent
did okay. So is this now we're going to see, like, live-action...
This was kind
action?
Of the boy power anticipation.
I mean, if they're all as good as this... I mean, I didn't know animals talking could look so real until I saw this movie.
It's a landmark from a technical standpoint.
So technically, they've gotten to the point, let's say, where Disney's said, okay, we don't have to do cartoons anymore. Look how good we can do with real animals that look like they're talking. So it depends on what else is. Let's think about the Disney treasure
canon.
Trove. What's in there?
What about Herbie the Love Bug? Oh, never mind. That was
a Pinocchio. They've had a Pinocchio with Drew Carey, actually. They had a Pinocchio.
All right.
Let me see.
I mean, they can go back and revisit anything. I mean, it's like...
That's going to be... Watch in the coming weeks. Hollywood Reporter or Deadline. There's going to be a ton of announcements of, and now this studio is coming
you
out
could
with...
Do, you could do The Little Mermaid. You could do it.
Wait, isn't that being adapted?
Is it being adapted?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Really?
I'm going to look it up.
Let's see. Right. Well, that would be very difficult to do the with real like.
But not if Mary Jo Kopechne was the mermaid.
I'm looking it up.
Oh my!
Ted, open the door! Ted, open the door! Okay, sorry. But we digress.
Finding Nemo is
come back,
those,
Nemo.
Those are Pixar.
Well, Sofia Coppola bailed on the live-action Little Mermaid, but it is still happening.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
And what? Give me some like.
What's another
one?
Like Flubber, Son of Flubber.
Flubber, Escape from Witch Mountain.
No, right.
There's lesser ones like The Emperor's New Groove and that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like nobody's. But when you talk about the classic Disney stuff, I mean. From the Snow White, is anybody? Well, Maleficent.
I bet they could get three or four Jungle Books out of this thing. Just his. First of all, he's like Bart Simpson. He doesn't seem to grow up at all. The kid like just stays. He's like Webster. I mean, he looks
what do
like
you mean?
He. Well, wasn't there a passage of time in this movie at all?
Oh.
And he just stays like being a kid. So they could do that with Jungle Book, and it just could be more adventures of him in the.
Yeah, as long as the real kid doesn't age a whole lot.
You get
lot,
another kid if the kid ages. Like, you know what I mean?
All right.
They could
can you
put him
any
in a.
Other classic Disney films, like in the from the Walt era and from the newer era.
Pocahontas. Which is technically
well, you
the
know,
new
you
world.
Could do the
How
Lion.
How would Fantasia be as like as the? Oh,
you could trippy. Do the Lion King, but this takes a lot of pages from the Lion King. If you think about it, like it's
all Disney movies are the same story.
A classic Disney death. That tiger is a page right out of Scar, who's voiced by Ben Kingsley. You know.
Right. Who I was sure was Patrick Stewart for the whole movie.
Oh, I thought it was Malcolm McDowell. I said to my wife, I said, that's Malcolm McDowell. And then it's like, Ben
isn't it fun to sit in a show with old people who think other old actors are really the part of the, that they.
I thought Patrick Stewart
that's
for a second.
So
I go, no,
funny.
No, it's Malcolm McDowell.
That's so,
I mean,
we were both wrong. It was Ben Kingsley.
All right, let's move on. Let's talk about a movie that we were all.
If you're just joining us, this is hour two now. No, it seems like we spent a long time talking about Jungle Book.
20 minutes.
I swear to God, this is my prediction. It's going to be one of the 10 or 8 or whatever nominees for Best Picture. I swear.
You don't think
and
it'll
it's going
lose,
to show up.
Like, lose pop, like,
of course,
it's early.
Of course,
in the year.
It's extremely early, but that's how bold my prediction is. And I think it's going to end up on a bunch of top 10 lists.
Well, you don't
lists.
Know what amazing
I know
movies
it'll be on,
await us this year.
It'll be on
year,
Time
possibly.
Magazine's top 10 list.
Well, Bill Bregoli, you know, I hate to put him on the spot, but if you could just
go ahead,
a couple
put
of
me
bars,
on the spot.
The Bare Necessities. If
you I don't even know.
I hated that scene. I hate it.
By the way, that scene where he's sitting on Bill Murray's belly as Bill is the raft as they go down that's when they're singing Bare Necessities, right?
That's Bare Necessities, right?
So, like, that's the fakest the fur or anything looked in the movie to me. So if you haven't seen the movie and you watch
well,
it, watch it. It looks like he's sitting
bear
on a
jamboree ride at Disney, at Disney World. Yeah.
Well, I do have a quick question.
It looks like he's sitting on a carpet. Watch for that.
Before we move on, I have a quick question because we discussed this earlier. Did the crowd influence you? I saw it basically with one other person in the theater.
Oh, right.
Completely
we saw
stale.
You saw it with a full audience last night, right? Or two nights ago?
Yeah.
I saw it a week ago with a very big crowd, and Justine saw it with one family. So she went to a private screening that
families.
Basically, probably
and
with.
They really killed it
probably
for me.
With, probably with the Disney family. I was influenced by how well it played in the room, slightly. I mean, people were applauding a little bit. They liked, they laughed and.
They weren't as vociferous with us last night, but we were in those, the same seats we saw Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, so were we the week before. Did you see it at that? Did you see it at 42nd Street?
I saw Batman versus Superman with the public.
So here's a little side thing for people listening to the podcast that you like these little side things. Like a lot of screening rooms in the city in Manhattan are closing. And for the first time in my doing this for 20 years, they're starting to show more and more movies in regular screening rooms, in regular movie theaters instead of screening rooms. And the point of all that is we all went to this 42nd Street.
The Dolby.
With the
these
seats that recline and for Batman that vibrate and do all kinds of things to your kidney. And this was amazing. I like that a lot. You're basically in a Barca lounge.
I didn't realize that they were doing away with what screening rooms are they doing away
Sony
with?
Sony closed.
No, well, that's because they sold the building and they're making it an apartment.
Yeah, they have a new screening room with 35 seats in it.
Yeah, don't you think that you've
think
gone to more?
Do you think the screening rooms are going away.
Okay,
yeah,
well,
they
if
have.
They're, if
they
they're,
have.
Yeah, of course. But
real estate.
Think about
theaters.
The last 10 movies you went to at a screening room.
Only a bit more public.
Half
theaters.
Of them were in a regular theater.
You're right.
Even the small indie ones too.
I hate when I am right, but it so happens.
Yeah, you're right.
So
right.
often with
it's
Neil.
Rare.
No, but Yeah, maybe they are building other ones, but for the for this period, whatever we're in right now, we're not
seeing. I was comfortable in a reclining chair by myself in the whole theater, and it just didn't help.
All right, we got to move on to Demolition, which is the new Jake Gyllenhaal movie, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who did the Dallas Buyers Club, which I really liked,
right,
and Wild with Reese Witherspoon, which I really did not like. But, you know, to each his own. This movie is, which I'm not giving anything away, it's the beginning of the movie. Jake Gyllenhaal is a successful investment banker, and he's in the car with his wife, and there's a tragic car accident, and his wife dies. His father-in-law...
In like the first 10 seconds.
Yeah.
It's very early on in the movie. And his father-in-law, played by Chris Cooper, who also happens to be his boss, tells him, you know, you got to keep it together. But as the movie progresses, he slowly just begins to unravel, and he goes on this destructive tear. He is in a room with a vending machine and puts money into the vending machine to get out a pack of M&Ms. The M&Ms get stuck in the machine. He writes a cathartic letter to the vending machine company where it's not just like your machine is busted and you owe me a dollar for the M&Ms, but he starts getting into this whole thing about how his wife died and blah, blah, blah. And this letter catches the eye of a customer service representative played by Naomi Watts, who he begins this oddball sort of relationship with.
If all this sounds extremely far-fetched, it is, but
however,
for some reason,
it works.
It totally. We're all in agreement on this?
Yeah,
it totally works.
Bill.
If there wasn't, I'll be honest, if there wasn't a publicist in the screening room when I saw it, I would have left. I would have
really?
Left. It was caught me on a bad day, too, but I would have left. It was...
Wait, that's
was it a day when you had bought something in a vending machine and it didn't come down?
I wasn't going to mention this. I have to counteract that. I had actually just passed out earlier that day. Like, just
really?
Was really, really
another
tired.
Another one of your drunken...
Low blood sugar, passed out. And I had to see the movie because I was doing the junket. And I was like, otherwise I would have canceled. And I was like, oh, man, the last thing I want to do is, like, go see a movie. And it actually calmed me and made me much more zen. And I was like, wow, this is
Do you
is
need
really...
a Snickers bar right now?
We're going
to
start...
Not to get all personal, but it's interesting that you had a bad day and it didn't...
So Bill and Justine and I all like it, and we're going to tell you why. But let's start with the dissenting opinion. Bill Bregoli, why don't you like this film?
It was... I hate to see rich people with problems, for one thing. An investment banker who loses his wife doesn't get any sympathy from me,
that's
frankly.
Funny.
In a car crash?
Yeah,
I could see if she left him
Did
for...
Did you know that I found out from doing the junket that she wasn't even going to be in the film?
Oh, it was going to be like
the wife.
Kevin Costner.
It was just going to be one shot of Jake. They hired an actress for him to
react to
talk to and relate to. But the director liked her so much.
Yeah, he liked her face.
Yeah, he decided to put her in the movie. But she originally wasn't in the movie.
I think those backstory shots of her and them going out early and stuff, I think those are good. I'm glad that they made that decision.
It's a stream of consciousness.
I like the movie very much. It's a quirky, offbeat, kind of weird vibe to it. And I kind of got into it. I mean... You know, it's also...
He's right about it does have a rich people's problems kind of vibe to it.
The point
that you're...
is about dismantling that idea of, you know, material possessions and whatnot. He actually wants to be bared down doing construction in the crappier house that Naomi Watts lives in versus his, you know, high-end,
high-tech
one.
Sure, he pays the guy's money so
Well, he
can...
pays them, I know, but well, it's like, it's more of like a shedding materialistic.
The movie is funny. That's what... It's funny. It has deadpan humor in it. I mean... He starts
Are you the person that asked them if this was a romantic comedy? Somebody famously asked them that, and they were like, yes, it is, and you're the first person.
No, I'm not.
Somebody at the junkets called it out as a rom-com, and they were like, yes.
No, but it's very funny. I mean, before he starts taking an anvil or a bulldozer actually in like, you know, like being very destructive, he starts on a smaller level, and he starts dismantling things, the dishwasher in his apartment, all these things.
So, and laying it out perfectly like it's in the manual, the photograph.
Right, so... Here's like an example of the comedy, which I thought was very, very funny. He's talking to Chris Cooper in Chris Cooper's office, who I mentioned earlier is his father-in-law and also his boss. And Chris Cooper's kind of giving him a hard time for like, are you the one that like took apart the door in the bathroom door? Are you the one that took this apart?
And he's like, that's my work.
Yes, he's, that's what I do. Yeah. And he goes, I'm really interested in that priceless grandfather clock that you you have behind you. And then, like, very subtly, it's called the callback, as Bill McCutty will tell you in humor. Like, about 40 minutes later into the movie, you see that the grandfather clock is being transported to the safer location.
Someplace safe.
By Chris Cooper. And I just, it's a lot of little...
Chris Cooper gives an amazing performance, and I think he does the same job pretty much in all movies, but, like, this one, it pays off in spades.
He adds gravitas. Right. Actually, I got to talk to him.
Oh, good.
For the press day, and he talked about how he prepares for his roles.
When I get my script, that's all I'm interested in. And I ask that I get my script as early as possible, you know, and if I'm lucky, I'll get the script 2-3 months before the shoot begins. And I will be working on that script every night, you know, and find something to dig deeper and deeper about the character, or just to ruminate and fill out in my head something about this character that the audience is never going to be aware of, you know, but it's important to me.
And then we got to talk to Jake Gyllenhaal, and he talked about why his character takes things apart.
Davis doesn't know how to express himself, but he knows that he has to. He's trying to figure out ways to do it. And so the first time he really kind of understands how to express himself is physically taking things apart as opposed to emotionally taking things apart. And so there is some sort of physical catharsis for him that eventually leads him towards an emotional one.
Jake Gyllenhaal said to me that he was reading the script, which does not sound humorous, he was laughing. I mean, there's a lot of really subtle humor in this
thing. Editing, I think, is really one of the best aspects of this movie. And Jean-Marc Vallée, as you mentioned, who's the director, he would shoot very in the moment. So he would tell Jake, all right, now we're going to do the emotional breakdown scene in the car. Let's go. Or he would give him, you know, strange music to listen to. All those scenes where he's dancing around the city on his headphones, he's being very childlike and expressive.
Right.
He would give him, you know, certain kinds of music and say, okay, go. And he would dance around the commuter.
Now, Bill Brigoli, knowing that, do you like the movie more?
No.
Are you hearing?
No. It just
can I ask you a question?
Yeah,
can we qualify you as a Jake Gyllenhaal fan or not a fan, or sort of
neutral?
Jake.
Yeah. It all depends on the
role.
Have
liked him in things.
Yeah,
had kind of a regenesis in the last few years. Yes.
I really liked Jake Gyllenhaal.
Prince of Persia.
Don't bring up Prince of Persia, because how they thought he was going to be an action star, I'll never know. This is the guy I'm pretty sure was the chick in Brokeback Mountain.
By the way, as I say every week on this show, and we talked about this since we were off last week on the podcast,
Thanks
TV
for your
show.
Cards and letters, by the way.
And this is this show is actually an after show to a television show we do on New York One called Talking Pictures, where out of all the hundreds of movies that are on demand in your cable box each month, we kind of pick 10, because these titles are only recognizable to, like, only a handful of titles are recognizable to the masses. And as Bill McCutty says every week,
we watch the bad movies so you don't have to, one of which was Not the Invitation, which did well in theaters last week. Okay, back to
yes.
you.
Well, anyway, and the show airs nationally, the television show, on Time Warner Cable. But we talked about Jake Gyllenhaal's career, and, you know, I think that he's an underrated actor. I think this guy is great in Rob. Like, if you look at, and I know you hate this movie, but I really love Love and Other Drugs. I think that he's funny, and he's a tremendous leading man and a romantic lead. I think if you look at him in something like Source Code, I mean, that's like a sci-fi thriller.
Look at he's Nightcrawler
excellent.
And Southpaw. Those were the
exactly.
last couple of years. Like, how radically different are those two roles?
Right. You
skinny
might not,
sociopath and a boxer.
Look at Zodiac. Look at
Look
at which he got an Academy Award nomination. Yeah. Look at his performance, which is a courageous role in Brokeback Mountain.
Well, I called him kind of a modern-day Gary Cooper, which sort of goes against what you guys are saying.
But you said last week on the TV show that you could plug him into anything.
I think you can sort of plug him into stuff that otherwise he wouldn't. I think he totally elevates. I think this movie that we're talking about now, Demolition, could have completely folded like the house that he demolishes if it hadn't been for he. And
movie.
Naomi Watts is really good in this, too. This is a casting kind of a movie.
It's an offbeat, quirky sensibility to the humor and the tone and the mood of the thing.
And it feels like a
and
real
you either gravitated to it, as Bill McCutty, Justine Browning, and myself have, Well, you don't gravitate to it.
I could see how someone wouldn't want
But an almost walkout Bill Bergoglio?
Almost walkout, yeah.
Wow.
And I was really, I didn't know where it was going.
No,
I found
I didn't
it really
either.
Interesting. I mean, we see so many predictable, formulaic Hollywood
right.
stuff.
This was so vastly
you know, it's
different
like,
than
you know,
anything
it's kind of like yeah. I go back to the movie Brooklyn. You know, people that don't like the movie Brooklyn say to me, you know, nothing really happens. And I'm going, well,
nothing
that's
really happens.
Kind of the point. You know, like people are going like, okay, is the girl in Brooklyn, Saoirse Ronan, is she going to be hit by a car when she finally finds happiness? Is the guy
going
to be
she's
going to
meet a guy and finally find happiness.
Well, anyway.
It's good real estate,
two,
too.
Two guys.
The point is we're always waiting for some major event. And, I mean, I just found this to be just an interesting character study of this guy who, and it's a look at grief.
Right.
And, you know, and it's a really wacky relationship between him and Naomi Watts.
Really interesting. From a parental standpoint of they – you can tell they weren't really for him as a son-in-law, and then they were, and then they're not. It really is really well done from that standpoint.
Well,
there's a party that they throw.
Yes, that's where some stuff is revealed at that party about his wife's background.
Yeah.
And you go like, oh, that's interesting. And they knew that the whole time before she was getting – like there's a lot of stuff. But Bergoglio's like,
as Mike said on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, sometimes you're talking about like, oh, maybe nothing happens in certain movies, and that could be off-putting. But the you know a cinematic experience, a kind of imprint of emotion, and here, as I said, a stream of consciousness, taking like a more of a psychological journey with someone of self-discovery. I think that's what it's really about. It's not necessarily that all these crazy reveals happen. At times, it's mostly people kind of just sitting and taking in.
Or acting and reacting to things that are happening in their lives.
Tell us about the Adderall Diaries, which is on demand,
well,
on DVD.
I'm only half recommending this.
On demand and in theaters.
Yeah. Which is what's cool about our show. I mean, we have shows that have movies that open the same day, and that's cool about VOD. This one is a James Franco movie. He's had the book.
One of
the
80 that
diaries.
Were released this year.
Yes.
A really good
but actually, it's one of the better ones for him from a narcissistic look at me kind of standpoint. He plays a self-centered author who's having difficulty with his agent and also his father, who we're led to believe was dead and then jumps up at a reading and says, no, I'm alive and everything my kid has written is bullshit. And it's a mess, but it's kind of a good mess in places. It's got an amazing supporting cast, including Christian Slater and Ed Harris. And I think it's worth watching a little bit for Amber Heard, who's been in a bunch of things that we've been talking about over the last couple of months.
What was the other last week?
She was just in...
That Christopher Walken, One More Time.
One More Time, yeah.
Right, another Christopher Walken thing.
Right,
where
another
he's supposed to be
movie.
This Sinatra-like singer, and he sings terribly. And it's and everybody thinks he sings great in the movie. Did you see?
No, I haven't.
You
seen
haven't
it.
Seen it. Well, Bill and I saw it, and
you
was,
don't understand. This is not really what I do.
I kind of want to now.
I think that I'm supposed
this
to play.
This is not
in this
good.
Movie.
Anyway, speaking of not good, those are three Christopher Walken impressions. Anyway, this is
I counted two.
This is kind of a mess, and Franco. It's not bad for a Franco effort, but he hired somebody he met at NYU while he's been studying there. And you said on the show today you're looking forward to seeing more of her stuff. I think she did direct some of the scenes between Ed Harris
yes, those
and
are the best scenes.
Franco well. And I think Franco comes off okay.
It's really her first.
Listen, it's based on this Stephen Elliott book.
Right.
And there's this is no easy adaptation to do. I mean, there's a lot going on in this book.
It's kind of a Bright Lights Big City kind of a thing. I didn't say that on the show today, but it's sort of trying to be that.
I mean, it's kind of a mess and all over the place, but I think it's a watchable mess. I mean, there's drug addiction in this, S&M sex, daddy issues, you know.
That S&M sex scene was like...
But it's about this guy, you know, that James Franco plays. He's portraying...
Are you speaking from experience?
But, it was a...
Sorry.
Is how would it have been a better?
you know what it was.
What could they have done more realistically?
I think they could have handled it a lot better. I think that they played it for shock value, in my opinion. I think it existed purely. I remember, it, you know, because I'd seen it during Tribeca. I remember the kind of uncomfortable, bizarre reaction that people had.
But it was weird. Like, what's with all the? You know, I know nobody in the audience is going to know what I'm talking about. this rope tied to all these clothespins, and it's like, do you want me to rip them off all at once?
No, he goes to, the way he feels emotion is he goes to these prostitutes that can hurt him in a way that makes him like feel more like I've experienced this myself. No, I sound like I know what I'm talking about. That's the takeaway I got from it. Can I tell you something really funny? I watched it last night on my computer on a link that we got sent. While my wife was watching 50 Shades of Grey on our like 90-inch TV.
I had
like picture in a picture, like sort of. Yeah, she was just curious because a friend of ours directed 50 Shades of Grey. So then she turned it off after a while. But it was really weird to be watching S&M on S&M, like from two different screens.
There was more S&M in the Franco movie.
The thing with the Adderall Diaries is there's a component in the book which is kind of really shortchanged in the film, which is that Stephen Elliott is following a true crime case.
Like Dominic Dunn with the OJ.
And it's a real case. Yes. I mean, Christian Slater
that
plays
this.
That
is what I was interested in. I wanted to hook on that.
Plays this husband who's on trial for murdering his wife. And that's a real case that happened. And,
do you think that allocution really happened in prison, though, the way they shot it in the film? I didn't think that would really happen. Slater would sit and go, finally allocutes to the crime.
Well, in a
prison.
Well,
that can't be true.
Well, the thing is, you got to shortchange something. This is such a complicated piece of writing.
A lot of story here.
But what I came away with on this, and I think it makes one point really well, and that's the point that what your memory tells you might not be exactly what is true. There are flashbacks to Franco's character as a kid being abused by his father, not sexually abused, just being physically abused.
And we didn't think sexually. Why are you looking at me?
Well, I guess it's the whole S&M conversation.
Double S&M viewing last
night. And one could also make that leap considering listening to this conversation because he's into this S&M thing. It might have been systemic.
No. He was abused as a kid.
But I'm saying, yeah. And then, you start to see, like, towards the end, you hear Ed Harris's version of the story, and there are some clues early on about what Ed and I think it just shows you that, like, yes, you believe things. This is what your memory's telling you. And, and I think that this first-time director, which you mentioned, Pamela Romanofsky, focused on that, and I think she got that across. So, yes, it's kind
That's
of all over.
It's
kind
movie.
Of all over the place. But well, I think it's a very watchable movie.
The book
movie.
Is incredibly, it's genre bending. It weaves in all of these different types of stories. And I think the movie could have benefited from just honing in on a few. Like we said, the true crime story with Christian Slater, I think that could have benefited from being elevated to the forefront a little bit more. That said, I like the way the flashback sequences were edited. I do feel that it was impactful. And I will look, as we said, I do look forward to what she has coming out in the future, but James Franco, to me, speaking of IMDb, when I looked up this film last night, all these other recommended movies came up of James Franco, right? And there was like 20 or 30 I'd never heard of, these little art house movies that he just cranks out constantly.
He's a working machine.
But I think that kind of takes away from...
Less is more, my friend.
Yeah, and I think that kind of takes away
from... Go to IMDb, like you said, I did the same thing, and you see like, you usually go to any actor, and you'll see like... One thing announced, one thing pre-production, one thing filming, like any popular. He's got like
37, and it takes away from when he does a film like this. It's just kind of tossed into the bunch.
There's too many James Franco projects.
Yeah, and it almost seems like he's not fully committed because, as I mentioned, he had the rights to this for 7 years. He and Pamela did, start to collaborate at NYU. I think it was about a 2-3 year process of developing the script. So you would expect to see some more passion behind it, behind the performance. But again, because he spread so thin, I think that it doesn't come across in this.
Before we go, just very quickly, Bill McCuddy and I saw a movie called Mr. Right with Anna Kendrick and Sam Rockwell. If you are floating around on demand and you say, gee, Sam Rockwell, I love Anna Kendrick. I love Pitch Perfect. Wasn't she great in Up in the Air? I want to rent this. Don't rent it. It's not good.
Is it better than Get a Job?
It's just not a
it's
good
It's a little, I don't know. She can save any scene. I think she's great, but...
They
and
have
by,
nice
the, by the way, follow her on Twitter if you're not doing that right now. She's very funny.
The premise of that is, she gets dumped by her boyfriend and falls for Sam Rockwell, who happens to be a professional assassin. And
happens all the time.
Their dynamic is okay, but when you get to the most of the movie is filled up with these horribly shot action scenes and these thugs that if they would have just stuck to the Rockwell Kendrick dynamic, you might have had something. But it's
if
not
you
good.
Are wandering around and that comes up and you don't see that, please, I gave it a push earlier. I want to mention again The Invitation, mm-hmm. which is a great little slow burn to a great to a cool payoff. And I want to also give a plug to The Wave, which was my critics' pick this week.
Good.
We don't have to spend time talking about it. Just
a Norwegian Hollywood
Yumpin' Yimini. It's
a disaster film based on Hollywood.
Get in the Volvo, kids, and go to higher ground because
I'm going to plug Truth, which was my critics' pick, which a lot of people don't agree with me. I think it makes some great points.
Yeah, you're alone in that.
And I'm going to promote what we're doing on the show next week. Is we're going to talk about Elvis and Nixon.
Oh, yeah, which you've seen, but I haven't.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, no, you've
seen it with you. Oh. And we're going to talk about some films that are at the Tribeca Film Festival, which starts this week in New York City. A lot of movies you'll be hearing a lot about.
I'm assuming we're going to go to a lot of those press conferences, so we'll have some folks talking about their Tribeca movies.
Maybe.
Okay.
There you go.
That's what I call a tease.
For Bill Brigoli.
Yes.
Justine Browning. Bill McCuddy.
She was great, wasn't she?
And myself, Neil Rosen. Thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. We'll talk to you next week.